Well, when Father Andrew left in June and I arrived in July, I think we both told you that we go way back. We've known each other since the beginning of seminary. And since getting here, I've resisted the temptation to tell any stories about Father Andrew. But today, it just was too good, so I got to share this one. And some disclaimers, I did ask his permission to share this story, and it's going to be embarrassing for both of us, so it's level playing field here. And also disclaimer, this is, you know, we're now Father Andrew and Father Mitchell. This is back whenever we were just Andrew and Mitchell, all right? And we had yet to achieve the state of perfection that we have now, okay? So this was probably my first year of seminary, Father Andrew's second year of seminary. I entered the year right after him. And I don't know if we were in the car or we were just hanging out somewhere, and we were listening to music, and the song changed, and the song Timber by Kesha featuring Pitbull came on. Some of you are laughing. For those of you who don't know Timber, I thought about printing out the lyrics and reading them, and then I realized that would be totally inappropriate in church. But you get the idea of what kind of song this is, okay? So the song comes on, and I just make the comment, "Oh, I love this song. This is my guilty pleasure." And Father Andrew, he did one of those where he, like, whips his head around, and he looks at me and he says, "Well, it would be a guilty pleasure if you felt guilty about it." Now, a few days ago, I recounted that story to him, and he did not remember doing that, but I remembered him doing that. it was a good example of today's gospel, of some nice fraternal correction, all right? That now every time I hear the song Timber, I always think twice, maybe I should turn this off, all right? Andrew told me not to listen to this. No, we've got a beautiful readings tonight about this maybe more difficult place in our Christian faith, this idea of correction. And part of what I think makes it difficult to, you know, embrace these readings and get excited about them is the concept that we've got to first understand, which is judgment. These are kind of not the happy, joyful, peaceful messages of the gospel. These are some of the more sober, serious things that Jesus calls us to embrace. And I say we first got to understand judgment. You know, culturally in our world, I think judgment is one of the worst sins people think we can commit, right? There's very few things we agree on across the board in the United States, but one of the things that it seems to me most everyone agrees on is you shouldn't judge people, right? I shouldn't be judgy. And I don't want to undermine that rare place of unity in our national discourse, but I do want to propose that I think sometimes we oversimplify the concept of judgment. After all, don't we want justice in our world? And in order to get justice, we've got to make a judgment about what's right and wrong. We have judges in our court system, and their whole job is to make judgments. And that we use that word judgment for more than just kind of being judgy. We judge measurements even in the kitchen or when I'm hanging pictures, and you want to make an accurate judgment. I think reflecting on all of these different but related meanings can help us flesh out what it means to judge. So what is judgment? Well, in its most technical and broad sense, a judgment is really neither good nor bad. A classical definition of judgment is that it's an act of the mind by which I determine a thing to be what it is in reality. A judgment is an act of the mind by which I determine a thing to be what it is. In that sense, we can't function without judgments, right? That's the only way to understand what the mind does. In the kitchen, I judge this amount of salt is going to be just perfect to draw out the flavor in my recipe, right? Or I'm sitting at the intersection and my green light goes and I see this car careening toward the intersection, not stopping, when it's got a red light. I'm going to judge that that's a threat to my safety. So I'm going to keep my foot firmly planted on the brake. Or maybe I judge that this guy is going to make a perfect addition to my fantasy football team. So I'm going to make some sacrifices to get him on my team. In light of all those examples, we might say, okay, yes, we should judge things, but maybe what Jesus is teaching us is we shouldn't judge people. But I don't think that quite captures the truth fully either. After all, that's the whole meaning, like I mentioned, of the justice system, right? It's somebody's job to literally sit there and say, I judge this person to be guilty because he went in and robbed this person's house. And we do this in our personal lives too, right? I think we ought to anyway, right? I judge this person to be untrustworthy because they can't stop gossiping about me. And I shared with them my vulnerable secrets and they shared them with the world. So I'm not going to give them my heart. I'm not going to let them in. Okay, that's a wise judgment to make. If we have kind of our world's extreme view of judgment just being bad and not thinking about it deeper, we can't understand the biblical story, frankly. The prophets of Israel, they were lightning rods of judgment. The prophets of Israel were constantly calling out the immorality, the idolatry of their own nation. Does this mean that doesn't jive with Jesus' command, thou shalt not judge? No, Jesus came to fulfill the law and the prophets, not to abolish their meaning. So in short, Jesus' command not to judge is not a command to bury our heads in the sand and pretend like actions don't have consequences. Rather, it's a command to trust in his mind, in his judgment, to recognize that any judgment I make in my mind is always going to be subject to error and fall short of the truth. Indeed, we can and should judge things and actions. But to leave the judgment of individual hearts and their intentions to the only one who knows the depth of them. It's our readings today that emphasize the other end of judgment than maybe we're used to thinking about. That these invitations in the scriptures to set about even calling out our friends and family is an important part of love. Letting the person you care about stay in their brokenness, in their lack of fulfillment, in, I'll say it, the misery of sin, is not love. Love involves calling each other to something higher, something greater, something more. Above all, love means desiring the person I care about to come to know and experience more fully in their heart the love of God. And you and I know in our own journeys, this involves a turning away from the bad toward the good. Right? We call that conversion in Christianity. And we all, please God, are trying to do that day in and day out for ourselves. And what Jesus emphasizes to us today is we do that for ourselves, and also it's an act of love to do that for another. Now, I think we all know this, but a lot of times it's easy to tell ourselves little white lies in this regard. Well, I'm not going to say the hard thing because, well, that would not be loving. Or I'm not going to make this person uncomfortable by challenging them in this or that area because, well, that's just not loving. I don't want to make them feel bad about, you know, how they're doing. And it's like, yes, that's true, and there's a truth in that because love involves kindness and mercy and compassion and seeking to understand where the other person is coming from. But that's not all that love is. Love is not indifferent to what is good. Love cares about what's right or wrong. That's what makes us love more, by doing good more and more and more. And when we do bad, love diminishes, it decreases. Maybe as I've been talking, you've got a situation coming up in your mind. There's somebody you want to call out. I'm not telling you to go be the John Wayne of correction, all right? Gunslinging left and right, telling everybody what's what and how to live their life. No, that's actually the gift of the gospel today, is Jesus gives us a system, a plan to do this. And it starts with, all right, that one-on-one, face-to-face conversation. Don't correct somebody over a text, all right? But to really love them well means looking them in the eye, sharing what's on your heart. Make a sandwich, right? Give them the affirmation, bring the challenge, another affirmation on the other end. People listen a lot better whenever you're buttering them up like that, right? But then, okay, maybe the person doesn't receive that. All right, Jesus says, get those other trusted people. Bring your friends together and invite them into the conversation, especially if it's something serious. And if it's something real serious, he reminds us, Jesus gives us our church to lead us into the truth. And we're here to help facilitate those conversations too. Above all, when you're discerning this type of conversation, there's a good rule of thumb. I know many folks in our parish have gone on Curcio weekends. There's a good rule of thumb that the Curcio movement gives us. It's a simple phrase. Talk to Jesus about your friend before you talk to your friend about Jesus. All right, so if you've got somebody that you're feeling moved to have a tough conversation with, you gotta pray about it. Don't just take it on yourself. Let Jesus call you to it and invite him into the conversation too. And I'm not just paying lip service to that. That's an essential part of the process, to sit here in the silence, to discern it with the Lord. Okay, Jesus, I'm feeling this movement to go and have this tough conversation with my friend. What do you think about it? Give me the grace, the wisdom to understand your mind, your heart, your justice, your mercy. Talk to Jesus about your friend before you talk to your friend about Jesus.